Yippee-ki-yay, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
It's a pleasure to be here, Johnny.
James Jones.
It's not a pleasure to be here, Johnny.
Guillaume Bayette.
Hello.
All right, well, we have a big show for you this week. We are finally going to do Retroactive on GoldenEye for the Wii a little bit later in the show, and we will be joined by a good friend for that segment as well. But first up, we've got new business as usual, and James is going to kick it off with a brand new old game that none of us saw coming, really.
A brand new old remake of old games. So I can't say nobody saw it coming, because in 2011, when they announced the handheld virtual console for the 3DS, we did a feature. A bunch of us are actually represented here. Game Boy games that we wanted to see come to the 3DS virtual console. And I actually went relatively early in the feature because I think I wrote it. And I asked for the lesser Game Boy Crystalis, understanding that that was the one Nintendo owned, so that was the one we were probably going to get. And I also asked for a game or a set of games that are kind of unnecessary. The Mega Man Extreme series, which Capcom created in the early 2000s, to reuse assets from the first two Mega Man X games.
Did they? I mean, it's Game Boy Color, so do they really reuse assets?
I was going to ask that.
They reuse design. Let's put it that way.
Oh, okay.
So, like, they did design a couple new characters, and they're just awful. I mean, they're. I'm going to read the caption I put under the two characters for this in the article. It simply reads, "I hate you both so much." Because they're terrible character design. But basically they said, "We need to come up with a contrivance that allows us to reserve a handful of Mega Man characters in an 8-bit limited color palette game on the Game Boy. And we want to make it in like 6 months." And that's what this game is. So as you can imagine, all the X games were built for the Super Nintendo and above. So they assume you have four buttons. They assume a certain sense of speed, which is kind of what sets that series apart from the Mega Man series. Things like dash. I mean, you start with a dash. You know, jumping is really integral. Speed is much more integral. The combat's quite a bit faster. As you can imagine, doing all this on the Game Boy or the Game Boy Color was going to be a particularly difficult challenge to transfer that experience to. And they did a fairly capable job of it. So I thought, well, you know, Capcom loves to reserve us their games. And in fact, this game exists as a means to reserve us things they've already created. I bet they're going to reserve us this game where they reserved us things. And sure enough, this week, they mysteriously decided that this was the week to release Mega Man Extreme for the Game Boy Color.
Well, there was a vote. That happened,
there was a right? vote, but there's almost no reason for this game to have been included in the running, except, it's okay.
I thought it was highly regarded, because, well, first, people voted for it, but I've heard almost nothing but good things.
It is a very competent game, it just doesn't try a whole lot. What I remember from this game a couple things when I played it when I was much younger. One, I remember the music is these really well-done 8-bit renditions of... They're fairly iconic music from the Super Nintendo Mega Man X games, 1 and 2 specifically. Those games have a certain musical flourish to them that sort of sets them apart from what the Mega Man franchise was trying to do. It sort of established this is its own thing. This isn't Mega Man, although it's totally Mega Man. And as you can imagine, transitioning that to the Game Boy sound hardware is a relatively tricky thing to accomplish, and they do a fairly competent job of it, but it, like a lot of things in this game, have these weird what's the best word for it? Concessions to the platform. So music's a good example, because when you're charging your shot, it makes a standard Mega Man brrrr sound as it charges, and it cuts out the high instruments on the instrument registry and just plays the low instruments of the music because the sound chip is in use and it can't do both.
Hmm.
It's kind of a weird thing that you sort of get used to as it goes, but it's very jarring to begin with. It does actually, I mean, you can see that when they built the music, they thought about this, so the music doesn't just completely fall away when you're charging, which must have been a relatively difficult thing to do at all times at any point in the game. It's a good mix of the low and high notes, so it still works. The control scheme is another interesting concession they had to come up with. In the Mega Man X games, there's a dedicated dash button, because you had four face buttons. One was shoot, one was jump, one was dash, and I don't think it ever used the fourth button, or if it did, it was for something relatively insignificant. The Game Boy Color obviously only has two, so the standard control mode is you double tap to dash, which works most of the time. There's some instances where it feels imprecise, and in the boss battles, that's kind of a bummer. And they built a secondary mode where the start button is the dash button, which is really screwy. And you would think that would be okay on the Game Boy, that was fine, because start button's right there, but on the 3DS, it's obviously not in a convenient location.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So it's a very weird experience to play this game, because it feels very competent. It feels like, you know, when they reworked all the art assets, knowing they had a very limited color palette, they still managed to kind of get the visual style right. I mean, it's very important that Mega Man be bright blue. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. And they do manage to pull things off, like, you know, Mega Man looks blue, Zero looks that red and white combo he's supposed to be, and everything looks right, even though you can tell it's obviously way, way downported. The sense of speed is all there, but playing it, it feels very strange, because I'm going back to these games I've played a bunch of times, the original Mega Man X games, and I'm still getting the experience, even though I know it's a lesser version, but I still enjoy it. And I found that when I picked up this game on the Virtual Console today, I still felt the same way I felt about it when I played it on the original Game Boy, which is I'm impressed by what they accomplished on the hardware. I'm impressed they're able to sort of elicit the emotions that I had when I was, you know, killing Chill Penguin for the 48th time in this much smaller version of the experience. But at the same time, there's obviously things about it that just aren't quite right. I like the way it tells story is kind of amusing. You don't think of Mega Man games having much of a story, but the X games certainly make more of an effort than some of the early original. And the way it does it is these still images of character faces and then incredibly slowly scrolling text that oftentimes reads like early 90s, you know, English translations. It's a very there's so many things here where you think, okay, this is really cool. But there's stuff just pops up. You're like, wait, that's weird and not right. And why is it like that?
Does someone still say the word damn?
No, I don't think damn's even in the original script. They do fail to translate one of the characters' names, though. So the Japanese version of his name just shows up. And
is it Boomer Kawanger?
No, it's Vile. The character Vile shows up early in the game. And in Japanese, his name is the onomatopoeia Vava, and so they're talking to him with the name Vava, V-A-V-A, and I had forgotten that. I remember running across it, going, "What the fuck, Capcom? Seriously, what is your problem?"
So, how much of the game is original? I mean, obviously, it has Chill Penguin and Vile, and some of these characters and bosses are the same, but are the level designs similar? Does it feel like a port, like a kind of awkward mutated port, or is there original content that's worth seeking out even if you know these games?
The levels are obviously inspired by the levels that these characters came from. Now, they're not the same. They aren't the same level. But they are definitely inspired. The enemies are straight up, you know, not only say copies, but they're straight up ports from the original games that they come from, the first two games. What the game does somewhat interestingly is I've already actually beaten the game today, and I got it around 7 and we started recording around 8:30, so that tells you it's not very long. And the way that they do that is the game's got a bunch of modes, and the first one is you only have four bosses. and they're four, they're like Storm Eagle and Flame Stack. And then there's another mode you unlock, which they call Hard Mode, and you get four more Mega Man X bosses, like Wheel Gator and Magna Centipede, which is an awesome boss.
Oh yeah, those are from the second game.
Yeah, so this is a remix of X1 and X2.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so bosses show up from both games here. I think eventually you unlock Zero. So there's content in here that is original, but there's a lot of reused stuff as well. Like the boss battles still play like they did before, except for the ones that you play as Zero, because obviously Zero didn't fight bosses in the first four Mega Man games. It's a weird mix of like they built these levels that are clearly inspired, but the bosses are straight up out of your memory. And the game conceit for this is someone has hacked the central computer where the memories of these enemies are stored, and now they have returned to cause havocs. Yep. it's like, I don't understand a single thing you just told me, game. Wow.
Does it have the upgrade capsules that I love so much? Are they the same abilities that you got in the original games?
They are very similar. In some of the Mega Man X games, the capsule purposes are a little bit different. You can't air dash because it would be almost impossible on the Game Boy control scheme.
Oh, yeah.
So instead, what they have you do is the boot upgrades, they break walls, which, whatever, I think is useful one time. And
yeah, they did that in the first game too, I think.
Yeah, I think that it was used a bit more in that game. In this game, I think there's only one time you use it, and that's to get another upgrade. And they auto-jump you. The boost jump you can do in the Mega Man X games off the wall when you're wall jumping, and you can boost across. It does that automatically. So every jump off the wall now, unless you drive yourself back into the wall, is a boost jump off, which is a conceit for the control scheme, and it works out really well. And that's kind of what I want to say. A lot of times you think, wow, this is limited, but they did a good job with it. Another good example is in the options menu. Because charging the weapon is so important and you have to manage all this other stuff with the two buttons you have, you can set the weapon to auto-charge. So basically, if you're not holding down the fire button, the weapon's charging. And then when you press it, he releases. And you can also set it so if you're holding down the button, he just rapid-fires. It's not a purist's way of playing it, but I played it that way because it does handle with the less buttons. It's a shockingly competent game for being as limited as it is. I think the sequel is better, and I would assume
Found out today the sequel's coming out at the end of May.
Yeah, as we know, it's coming. But mm-hmm. I think they're roughly comparable. I just think the sequel has some better enemies in it.
Okay.
So it's a cool game, and if for anything else, it's interesting to see how they translated this series that was all about, now we're 16-bit, look what we can do, back into this 8-bit with an even more limited color scheme than the NES.
Right.
And they did okay.
Yeah, and in between them, we're getting a bunch of black and white Game Boy Mega Man games.
That's so weird.
I think the one that most people seem to think is the most interesting is Mega Man 5, which is coming out towards the end of the month.
Yeah, it's the one that has original content.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, it's not any kind of down, because the other, like Mega Man 1 through 4 on Game Boy were all kind of like weird down ports from the NES games.
Yeah, they bear a lot in common with Extreme. I think Extreme attempted to do a little bit more. I mean, Extreme introduces some limited RPG mechanics, very limited, DNA Soul stuff. But, I mean, that's Extreme 2, though. But, I mean, it's really... It's the same kind of vibe, you know. They wanted to create something that was a portable experience, like a bite-sized version of what you get on the home console.
I'm probably going to support it. I might check out Extreme. I think I'm more interested in 5, and maybe more interested in Extreme 2, considering that seems to be the superior experience. And then I'm definitely interested in Battle Network 3, which is coming out on Wii U.
I was really surprised to hear they went with 3, because
three is regarded as the best one, which is fantastic that they're like, you know, these games are all pretty similar. We don't really expect people to buy 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, blah blah, you know. Let's just jump to the one that everybody really is waiting for anyway, and maybe we can sell a lot of copies of that. And I can only imagine that's the thinking behind it, and I'm really glad that they're doing it that way.
I remember I loved 2 and then went back and played 1, and it was so much vastly better in ways I don't expect Capcom to fix games iteratively, because they were putting those out like every 11 months. Like just absurdly quick. And I remember thinking, wow, this is way better. And I never got around to 3, so I'm glad to see it's coming, and I'm worried that this is going to be the renaissance of me giving Capcom absurd amounts of money for Mega Man games. Because we've covered this on the show before. I own Mega Man X2 and X3 at least 4 different ways. This is bad for me personally.
Hey, I'm just glad that Capcom is acknowledging Mega Man's existence, and they are trying to sell us Mega Man games. All right, well, let's move on, and I'll go next with new business, and I've been playing another kind of retro revival called NES Remix 2. I did not play the first NES Remix. I think I've been consistent on the show about this. I've always found the concept very interesting and really exciting. The actual content of that first game was so unappealing with all those black box NES games. I was tempted, and I came close to buying it a couple of times. But I watched some videos and I read more about it, and I just decided my life is too short to be playing hockey and baseball and ice climbers. But NES Remix 2 just has a vastly superior lineup of games, and the formula is exactly the same. And I've actually seen this leveled as a criticism against. It's like, it's the same menus, it's the same music, everything is done the same way. It's just different NES games. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I wanted, and that's what I got. And, but this is my first time actually playing one of these NES Remix games. And so it's been interesting for me to catch up a little bit on the experience that, you know, I think a lot of people listening to the show, had already tried out for themselves back in January, I guess, or very late December. When the first one came out.
Near the end of the year.
I really, really like this game. I think it's fantastic. I think it's so much fun. The presentation is wonderful. It's fast-paced. It's not as fast-paced as WarioWare, but it's fast enough that you can roll from one challenge into the other without really having to stop and think, do I want to keep playing? It's fast enough that, you know, you just kind of keep rolling right on through it. And that's really what you want here. It's very addictive. And the game feels rewarding, you know. I mean, not all challenges are created equal, but for the most part, I would say, you know, most of the games, they start out and they start off with the first level is more or less a tutorial. It's like, you know, do the real basic things. Let's make sure you understand the basic mechanics, even if you've never...
You know, it'll be like jump. And you're like, oh, okay.
Slightly more complicated than that, but not much more. They don't insult your intelligence, James.
In Remix 1, there is literally a challenge that is jump.
Okay, well, that's stupid. They don't do that. But they Good. Do teach you to play these games. It's like a crash course. And then from there on, it rolls out. But I think especially with the games that most people are a lot more familiar with, like Mario 2, Mario 3, Zelda 2, Metroid even, before long, even like maybe halfway through the challenges for these games, and especially towards the end, they've moved way beyond asking you to just play this little piece of a level, you know, or try to complete this kind of miniature subset of a challenge. And it gets more into do this weird thing that only really high level players ever would have done in the original game. You know, it's like play this one very memorable, like I'll give you an example. In Mario 3, one of the challenges is get every single coin on the ghost ship. You know, the ghost airship or the treasure ship that flies through the air and sort of randomly shows up. And if you go there, you can get a ton of coins, and there's like power-ups, and it's awesome. You get one-ups. You know, some people might play through that game and never see it, or they see it and they accidentally fall off or something, and they don't do it well. And this game just jumps you straight to it, and it says, do this. Or if you go all the way to the end, and I'm not even to the remixes yet, this is just playing through the normal challenges that are set aside for each one of the games in the collection. But like the very last Mario 3 challenge is defeat Bowser while wearing the frog suit. Which is something you can totally do in the original game, but it's a complete pain in the ass. And not many people probably ever bothered or were successful in doing it. And frankly, it's pretty hard to do. I mean, Mario just jumps and moves in a weird way. And so it's a little bit difficult to dodge those fireballs. But the nice thing is the challenge starts with you already in that battle. So you don't have to play through the castle. You don't have to survive. I mean, it gives you the frog suit. But of course, if you get hit, you don't have the frog suit anymore and you immediately fail the challenge. So it is challenging. Mm-hmm. It's very challenging, but
it's better than the alternative where you would have to go through the entire level without getting hit a single time, because then you lose that suit and you're not going to get back.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's better for me because I don't want to, you know, for me, it's fun to just go back and play Mario 3 at all. That's not a game I'm going to go back to and try to like master class, which I might have done when I was 8 years old. But, you know, NES Remix 2 makes it so that you can try some of these really esoteric things that you might have tried to do when you were a kid. And in a lot of cases, it just reminds me of all the weird stuff that's in these games that I used to try to do. You know, I mean, there in Mario 2, there's a challenge where you have to ride on one of Birdo's eggs across the ocean, and then you find there's an island over there with a magic potion and, you know, a sub-zone and everything. So it's like that stuff was in the game, but people might not have even ever found it when they were originally playing it. And even if you did, you might have sort of forgotten. And so there, it's bringing back a lot of latent memories of these weird things in the game. And there's stuff like, you know, in Metroid, they ask you to defeat Ridley and they put you right in front of him. You know, I mean, like they give you everything that you need to do. They show that some of the challenges are all about just find the secret place, and they'll even show you where the secret path is, but you just have to kind of figure out how to navigate it and get to it. And I think this stuff is really cool. I think it's very self-aware. It's very much, it's very cognizant of the way that we played these games back in the day. And especially in the games that are more well-known, the challenges really focus on doing the most interesting things in those games. So it's not just play some random level or, you know, go through this part without getting hit or defeat this boss. It's like do it in a certain way or go do this optional thing that is kind of a little more fun, a little more exciting than just playing the game normally. And on the flip side, you've got stuff like Wario's Woods and, you know, some of the less well-known games that I think the challenges are more about just making sure you can actually play the game. Like they're more basic, they're more, you know, maybe they teach you a couple of little tricks, but I think they know better than to assume that everybody knows how to play those games and that you're looking for the most hardcore, weird, oddball thing that you might challenge yourself with. And it's more like just beat this level. And that's hard enough because the NES Remix 2 is not really set up to teach you to play something like Wario's Woods. Like the first challenge, it teaches you like the bare minimum mechanics to kind of grasp what's going on.
Well, the first challenge is actually watch the tutorial.
right, which takes way too long. But but most of the other ones, they're really pretty basic challenges, and I still struggled with some of them because I get, in general, I kind of get the gist of how to play this game after, you know, going through some of these challenges, but I don't understand the subtleties and I don't have the full game. So I haven't played it long enough to kind of get into the rhythm of it and sort of understand the flow of the puzzles in Wario's Woods. And you're not gonna from NES Remix 2. Like if you're interested in that, then I guess go buy the game. It's only $5.
I'm kind of, it kind of whet my appetite for that game. Like I'm like, oh, okay, this is interesting and I'd like to play more, but there's so much bitching about that game being included on Twitter and on the Miiverse. People are just like, wow, this is the worst game. I can't believe that they put that in there.
I don't get it. I think it's fine. You know, it was difficult to adjust to because I'd never ever played Wario's Woods before this. I'd always been curious about it, but I didn't know anybody who owned it because that game came out in like 93 or 94 on NES.
The last NES game, I believe.
Like nobody owned that game.
The only ESRB rated NES
game. So for me, NES Remix 2 is valuable just as a way to kind of tour through some of this stuff, even though, you know, most of these games I did own or I had friends who had them and I played them. But something like Wario's Woods is a game I might never have played otherwise. And it's like, I don't know that I'm going to go out and spend $5 for the whole thing, but at least I got to sample it and I think it's interesting. You know, like it's not my favorite one in the bunch, obviously, but I think it's cool and I'm really glad they included it. But, you know, in other games like Punch-Out, NES Remix 2 can actually teach you to play Punch-Out, you know, because that game is all about learning these patterns and understanding when to use certain moves. And the challenges are set up to tell you, in some cases, exactly what you need to do. And the trick in Punch-Out is just executing it. You know, I mean, you have to be fast. You have to have good reflexes. And it'll tell you exactly what to do. And as long as you kind of are focused on that and really put yourself, okay, I got to watch what he's doing. I got to wait for his mouth to open. And then I punch him. Then the game is not, it's not so much about learning how to defeat King Hippo. It's just, can you pull it off? And that's now, what these games are about.
Do they require you to maintain it, though, like it does in the original game? Because that's one of the sort of sub-challenges is, can you maintain this pattern and execute it properly for an extended period of time?
No, in most cases, it's just, can you do it once?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
What's interesting about Punch-Out is that the Wii game actually kind of had this mode in it. I mean, like, it had these challenges that, you know, put you against every boxer and basically told you how to beat them, and they were, you know, they were teaching you how to play the game. But it was, I can't remember exactly, but I think you had to unlock it, which was stupid because, you know, like it would have been useful to be able to do it before going through the actual full game.
Yeah, I don't even remember that. And I played through that game, but maybe I never unlocked it. Anyway, NES Remix 2 is just so much fun. I'm really loving it. I think the emulation is really fantastic. Some of these games do have weird graphical artifacts. Like I think Kirby's Adventure has some weird stuff going on at the edges of the screen. It's stuff that it looks, to me, it kind of looks old school. Like it looks like that stuff was in the original game. I can't say for sure because it's been a while like since Super I played Mario 3. It, but yeah, Mario 3 has some weird art. And, you know, Metroid famously has lots of graphical glitches just throughout the entire game. That game is just kind of a mess. It's just a bad engine. But, you know, so that stuff is usually maintained. But in a lot of cases, they've done little things that actually, I think, make these games look better than they did originally. Like Kirby in particular, I think the colors are more vibrant than the original NES. Maybe it's because I played that game on an RF switch on a crappy tube TV back in, you know, 91, 92 when it first came out. But I think it looks better on NES Remix 2. And several of these games, I've been impressed at just how vibrant they look. And then, of course, once you get in the remix stages, they really go a lot farther in terms of kind of brushing up this stuff. They add shadows to everything, even like in, you know, Super Mario Brothers or Mario 2. They do things to kind of pull the foreground away. It's not in 3D, obviously, because it's a Wii U game, but it has almost a kind of a 3D depth effect on it.
Yeah.
And I think it looks really striking and really cool. You know, it's like it's not authentic, but these are remix stages. They're not supposed to be authentic anyway. And it makes these look so cool and exciting, even for games that you're very familiar with.
Mm. Now, something that is in NES Remix 2 that you wouldn't have experienced is the championship mode, which is unlocked when you own both of the games. And I played a little bit with that. Like the championship thing is a reference to that championship cart where I think the challenges were collect this many coins in Super Mario, the first one, and then, you know, do a lap in Rad Racer. And it ended with Tetris. And so, of course, here Nintendo doesn't have the rights to Tetris anymore. They don't have Rad Racer anymore because that was a Rareware game.
No, it was Square.
It was Square? Yeah. Oh,
Squaresoft made Rad Racer. Yes, sir.
Huh. All right.
It's so bad.
So they don't have that. But so now it's collect 50 coins in Super Mario 1.
Which is a lot of coins.
It is. Like, it goes on for way too long. Collect 25 coins in Super Mario 3, which I think is kind of lame because it's exactly the same challenge. And then it ends with Dr. Mario. And of course, at least the spirit is kind of the same. I mean, like, the goal is to finish the first two games as fast as you can, because the actual, you know, the game that will pay off the most is the puzzle game at the end. And if you know how to set up a combo in Dr. Mario, well, you're well on your way to be on the daily leaderboards. I've always been on top 100, so I guess, you know, maybe that's the number of people who actually own both games, or maybe it's just, I don't know, people don't really understand that mode yet, or they're not very good at Dr. Mario, or I don't know, but...
Or you're so awesome.
No, I'm not, I'm terrible. I'm rubbish at Dr. Mario. but it's really, I found myself really addicted to it. But then I realized, oh, they're daily. Like, they reset every day. So I would have to keep doing that all the time.
Is it the same weird Dr. Mario level every time?
No, it's like once you're in Dr. Mario, it's random. Like, you're never going to get the same positions of the, you know, viruses. Even when you play it right after, you just on the same day.
So you could get the advantage of getting a much easier puzzle than somebody else.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of
I think that was the case with Tetris too, though, in the original. I mean, the sequence of blocks is probably random.
Yeah, you finish as many of the levels as you can in Dr. Mario while doing as many combos as you can, which is pretty hard. It's not an easy game. But yeah, it's very fun.
Yeah, I think it's great that they included that as a bonus for people who have both, but it certainly is not even remotely tempting me to want to go back and buy the first one and play through it just so I can unlock the tournament mode. I don't care at all. But I'm extremely happy with NES Remix 2. It is exactly what I wanted. It's exactly what I hoped for. And I'm with our friend Justin Baker on the website staff. I'm all for Nintendo doing more of these in whatever weird, variations they want to do. And I mean, the obvious one that I think a lot of us are hoping for is Super Nintendo Remix. And I think that could very well happen. It would probably be a lot more work, because I'm sure these old 8-bit games are relatively easy to hack, whereas the Super Nintendo ones are probably a lot more complex. But I would...
Well, you figure the art assets they have... The art assets they have to recreate for HD sets are a lot simpler on the NES.
Sure, yeah, but I would be thrilled to have more NES Remix or more of these Remix games. Period. But I'm really happy. I think you get a lot of value for your money in NES Remix 2. I did briefly mess around with Super Luigi Brothers, but it's not really. It's okay. Like, there's no save function, you know. So it's a pretty, other than the weird tweaks they made where you play backwards and you're controlling Luigi. It is exactly
Who
Super
does
Mario
have
Brothers.
His floaty jump and higher jump.
Yeah, it does, which I don't like. It's enough to throw you off, which is kind of the point. Like, you do play more cautiously because it feels weird enough that...
Right. The goal is to make you think this is weird.
Yeah, and it is. But I played through and I think I took the warp and I messed up around 4-2 maybe. And then I realized that there's no save state or anything. You know, you have to just start over from the beginning, or I guess you could continue, but I just decided I'd rather go play more NES Remix 2 than mess around with Super Luigi. But again, it's basically a bonus and it's pretty cool. And that game, the original Super Mario Brothers, is otherwise, it's not in NES Remix 2 at all. Cause it was in the first
one. Right. Cause it's in one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it really does make this just that much better of a value proposition. So I'm pretty thrilled about it. I really like it. I would highly recommend it. I think it will probably make you think that some of those old games aren't as much fun as you remember. I mean, I think Kirby's Adventure did not come across very well. Maybe it's just
not
very...
The controls are weird. They changed them over the years, and so the original is really, it's off-putting, kind of, because you're always...
It's a little stiff compared to what Kirby has become.
Yeah, you're always blowing up without really wanting to, just... slightly touching...
Well, I mean, part of that's the two-button thing. You only had two buttons, so they had to come up with some mechanism to let you blow up and do other stuff,
right.
Other activity.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that, but the challenge is also just some of them aren't explained very well, and I had a lot more trouble than I would have expected with a couple of those. There's one in particular with the umbrella that I just found infuriating. It took me a long time to get through that.
Oh, using the umbrella in Kirby Adventure is sort of like the master techniques of that game.
Yeah, well, it's...
Cause it, you can break the hell out of that game with the umbrella.
Yeah, and it falls right in the middle of the challenges, and I got stuck on it for a while, and I got really pissed. And I've eventually figured out what I was doing. You have to press up and down a lot and kind of control the rate at which the wind carries you. But I didn't like it. I like that game. In fact, I mean, if you asked me what my favorite Kirby games are, I think Kirby's Adventure would probably be in the top three. I just don't think it translates very well to this remix formula and the challenges that they give you. And stuff like Dr. Mario, I don't think it was ever really all that fantastic of a game. I think it really pales in comparison to Tetris.
Do they make use of Kirby's minigames? Cause I mean,
yes, one thing, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. You do have to play Quick Draw in one of the challenges.
Oh, I love Quick Draw.
I like it, but it is so difficult on
Wii U. It's hard. The late stages of Quick Draw.
Keep in mind, there are no wired controllers for Wii U. So yeah, right. There is wireless latency, period. And whether you watch the screen on the gamepad or watch the TV, it doesn't matter. There is latency and there's nothing you can do about it. And that game is, you're literally dealing with like hundredths of a second reaction times.
It'll tell you missed it by like 1/100th of a second.
Yep. Yeah. And I think there's just too much latency in the system. It's not a good match. I think it was a bad decision to put that in the game. And I eventually passed it. I think I got the 3 stars on it, but I eventually essentially guessing when it was going to happen. You know, on the last one, you have to be so precise, so fast to defeat the enemy.
I will tell you that in the original game, when you fight DDD is the last one, I believe.
Yeah. So
you basically have to guess anyway.
Yeah, they don't include that one, at least. They step just before that.
Oh, yeah, that's the one. I mean, in that one, you basically have to guess. Yeah. I mean, even in the NES original with a wired controller.
Well, I had to guess on this one. I think it comes down to the technology, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, some of these other ones I think are a lot more fun than you might expect. I mean, Metroid is not a game that seems really well suited.
Good.
To these kind of random challenges like this, but I think it works out really well. I think Mario 2, it reminded me of a lot of the weird stuff that's in that game that I had kind of forgotten about. And the remix levels are, you know, some of them are dumb, some of them are amazing. There's a wide variety, but they're all pretty interesting. And there's a bunch of, I think there's about 40 of those, at least 40 remix levels in this game. So there's a lot of challenges to get through. And, you know, it's really fun to unlock the stamps. They have a ton, I think there's 100 stamps in the game. So if you're really into that, from 3D World and other games, then, you're gonna enjoy this a lot. I think pretty much anyone listening to this podcast would probably have a really good time with Remix too.
I will say one of the best parts of the original Remix was how people abused the stamp system.
Oh, of course, yeah. You can just make some horrible things with it.
Yeah, chimeras. Yeah, just Bowser with a Goomba head and a lizard. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway. And some really inappropriate stuff.
I'm sure some people got banned from the Miiverse because of those stamps.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun to see what comes out of that, but I obviously recommend NES Remix 2 quite a bit. All right, so let's move on to what Guillaume has been playing.
All right, so I've been playing Child of Light. I'm actually playing this for review for the website, but we did not receive a review code in advance, so I'm just kind of, you know, rushing through it and sweating a lot and swearing profusely. But I'm still having a good time. So this game got a lot of attention before its release, of course, and Ubisoft has a lot of marketing power. So it's, you know, this kind of indie title that was developed in-house, using the engine of Rayman Legends.
Yeah, the UbiArt engine.
Exactly. And so one guy in Ubisoft Montreal decided to make this kind of vaguely Japanese RPG-inspired game. And it's a, you know, the view when you're exploring the world is 2D side-scrolling. And for the most part, you can just hover around. So it's kind of like, I don't know, it doesn't really, there's no platforming. It's more like you just comb through the level and try to find every doodad. And when you see an enemy just hanging around, you try to surprise it by attacking it from behind. And from then on, you enter this turn-based fighting system where everyone's kind of progressing on this progress bar, this attack bar. And when they get to a certain point on the bar, that means that they can start initiating an action. So that goes for you and the enemies. And when they start initiating an action, like some actions take longer than others. some are very, very fast. So you're trying to use that to attack before the enemy, and if you can attack them before they finish their attack, then you just knock them back, you know, and they won't perform their action, and so you'll gain some time, and you know, like you'll avoid getting damage and stuff like that. But of course, the enemies can do the same to you. So it's really like it's really all about the timing of your attacks and when to defend and when to focus on an enemy. Like I'm playing on hard. There's two difficulty levels at the beginning, normal and hard. So I chose the hard one because I had heard that normal was a little bit too easy. And it's really keeping me on my toes, and I really have to use strategy to defeat them. And it's one of the rare RPGs where just everyone focusing on the one guy to take everyone, you know, like a whole party one at a time is not really working, you know. Or at least it's not the best way to do it. What you want to do is always be interfering with the enemy's attacks. So it has you really focusing on different enemies all the time. And I really like that kind of fighting system.
Yeah, I agree. I've been playing it on PS4 this week because I wanted those extra 360 Ps. But I've heard the Wii U version is very good, and if that's the one you have access to, I don't think you should hesitate, because I really like this game. I think it looks amazing, it sounds really nice, and the battle system is really fun. I do recommend turning it up to hard. If you've played other RPGs, you know, if you've played Earthbound and, you know, Paper Mario and Final Fantasy and stuff like that, even on the hard difficulty setting, the game is not that hard. And mm-hmm. and I know some people who've played it on the normal have found it to be so easy that it's actually not as enjoyable. So I think you should not at all be afraid to crank this up to hard, because it's not that hard even then. But I've really enjoyed it quite a bit so far.
Yeah, and in addition to controlling the main character, you're always controlling this guy called Ing Nicholas or something, this kind of firefly thing that you control with the right control stick, and you use it to shine light on things to solve very simple puzzles. But also during combat, you can use it to heal yourself, or you can use it to get in the way of an enemy and slow it down. And so there's some strategy there, and you know what you want to be doing with the limited power that you have. Because eventually you're going to run out of energy, and then you're not going to be able to slow down the enemies anymore using that technique. So,
doing that strategically can make a big difference in the battles.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'd say that the art and the combat are definitely the two things that I enjoy the most about it. The story so far, I'm not sure if I even... Like, I know what's going on, but I don't really care. All the dialogue is in rhyme. My girlfriend, who's an English doctor,
that's right,
doesn't really appreciate it. Like she's like, wow, this is awful.
I've heard some people describe the rhyming as quote unnecessary, abysmal, and disgusting. So.
It's a great idea. It fits with the game. It fits with the world they've created. It fits with the style of the artwork and the tone of the story. I'm cool with it in concept, but the writing just isn't that great. It just doesn't support the idea. It ends up feeling very forced.
Yeah, apparently the writer who also penned Far Cry 3.
It's roughly the same game. Yeah.
he was like boasting, oh yeah, like this is my text, and I did not have an editor. And a lot of people on Twitter are like, wow, that's not something to be proud of or desirable at all. And yeah, like it really shows that no one went over what he wrote and said, well, you know, like there's a couple of things here that needs fixing.
Yeah, sometimes the meter is a little off, you know. It's not exactly poetry. Yes, it rhymes, but if you tried to say it out loud, it doesn't sound good. And I think if the game had – it has some voice acting every now and then, but a lot of the text is just written out, and it's still in rhyme. And if you actually try to sound that out in your head or even say it out loud, it just doesn't really sound good. And I think if they had actually had to go through the process of having people say this stuff and record it out loud, they probably would have gone back and rewritten a lot of it to make it flow better. But as it is, it just doesn't really work. I mean, it does it does technically rhyme, but that not in a great way.
I would love for them to have described this game as from the writer of Far Cry 3.
You know, people can write different kinds of things. So I just
I think that would have been hilarious.
The same guy who writes it's just so bullshit. It's like, you know, people can write different kinds of things. I think that's so irrelevant.
I don't know. I guess the issue I have more is that a video game writer tried to write a fairy tale and did not have the benefit of an editor, and that's unfortunate. You know, like it's not completely rubbish. I mean, there are some things I like about the story so far. There's this character that's pretty cool that seems to be incapable of rhyming. She's always looking for words, and then she ends up picking up the wrong one, and everyone is annoyed at her. They're just like, "Don't you mean, you know, addition?" Yeah. Or like, and so that's pretty funny. So it's not, you know, like I don't want to back
really
too much.
That's not really storytelling. That's just dialogue. That's being good at dialogue. Dialogue and characterization is different than storytelling a lot of times.
Right. But anyway, I'm not ready to say that, okay, like don't even read. Like just press A as fast as you can.
I will say there are some reviews that basically just say press A as fast as you can.
But that's, in my opinion, I would do that like with most video games. So it doesn't offend me more than that. It's just, I guess it just stands out more because here they're trying to rhyme and they're trying to do stuff that they can't really quite pull off.
Yeah, it's ambitious and it doesn't quite live up to the ambition.
Yeah. Anyway, Child of Light, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, me too. Okay, let's wrap up new business with Mr. John Lindemann.
Yeah, I just have some quick thoughts on the Mario Golf 3DS demo. And I pretty much agree with James, really. I mean, it's rare. So just make note of this to our audience. It didn't really wow me. I mean, I enjoyed it. You know, I played through all three courses, and I played through, there's the two, I don't know how you could describe them.
They're basically the mini game
ones. I played through the coin one, which I didn't really enjoy that very much, just because the goal, I guess, is to hit the coin in midair, and where they placed the first coin was just a really difficult spot for me.
Like, yeah, they're mini games, but you're still expected to do par on
the
full court.
Yeah, you didn't get par for this impossible place we put these rings? How dare you?
Yeah, for the first coin, they put me way out, and it took me two strokes with a wood to even get onto the green, and then I actually had to, the coin was in such an awkward angle that I would have had to actually use my pitching wedge to chip upwards. It was just crazy.
Well, look at you, Mr. Golf.
Well, hey, man, I played a little bit of Mario Golf, you know. I've been on the links a few times, but yeah, just the way the placement of the coin was just like, it was just made it really difficult to actually make par. So I had a pretty hard time with that. It was just kind of annoying.
See, I felt that same way about the ring one. Like the ring demo, they're putting you on this island that's completely out of the way of where you need to go. It's like, this is not helpful.
Yeah. So. Yeah, so it kind of left me kind of flat. I know that you unlock a lot of, I think, more interesting courses. Unfortunately, they aren't in the demo, which doesn't really lend itself to getting people interested in it, I don't think. Because it just...
Make a good demo.
Yeah, I mean,
wait, are you saying Nintendo doesn't know how to make a good demo?
Well...
Look, there are differences between a good demo and this game's demo.
Yeah, this game's demo, it basically threw in the... three of the blandest courses that make you say, yep, this is Mario Golf. Okay, like there's nothing really unique about it, but that's the thing. When you read the actual description of the full-fledged game and you read reviews, there's actually a lot more stuff in there that would make you more interested in the game, like the online tournaments and you know, stuff like that, and the courses that you can unlock that apparently have a whole lot more usage of items and stuff like that. I didn't really use the items too much in this one, but I know I talked to James, and you know, he got to use the items a little bit. I know there's stuff that can, you know, freeze water and, you know, stuff like that. So, but I'm still interested in it, but my worry with it is that kind of like, you know, one of the like Mario Kart 7, that I would kind of maybe play it for a month and then just completely just put it on the shelf sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think this is the, like there's only maybe two or three days by the time you're listening to this to do it. But Mario Golf 64 is free on Club Nintendo, or free, like 250 coins. But so I got that, and I get the feeling that I'm going to get my fill of Mario Golf with that. And
yeah.
It won't have cost me $30. So.
Yeah, yeah, and there's small things that are better. I read a review that brought up a really good point. The putting is much better in Mario Golf 64 because it's a lot better because you have kind of the bigger screen and you have the grid that overlays the putting surface, and that's a lot harder to read on the 3DS because it's the contours are harder to tell from the
Yeah, I had a lot of trouble with that. It would seem to pitch, and then I realized there was a contour there.
Hmm. So it's harder to read that way. So I don't know.
That seems like a problem in a golf game.
Yeah, it's a problem.
A little bit.
So,
yeah, the putting never really was the strong suit of the Mario Golf games.
Yeah.
I would say like even golf was never really the strong suit of the Mario Golf games.
Yeah, I think that's the point.
It's a pretty good golf
game. I think that's the point.
Yeah.
The demo is trying too hard to be a golf game, not hard enough to be a Mario game.
All the Mario Golf games are golf games first. I mean, the Mario Golf Toadstool Tour only had one Mario course. The rest was all basically normal courses, and it was still a lot of fun. And you know, like you had all the Mario characters, but it was a golf game.
Yeah,
and I don't think I don't know. I don't think it's a negative or a positive. I don't know.
I really like them. I mean,
if you've got a Nintendo system, then it's your Hot Shots Golf.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Understood.
Stuff.
I mean, yeah. Really, my bias against golf video games is coming out here. I've never found them remotely appealing. So, it's you know, I've played them. I think the only time I can remember having a really good time with one of these was the 64 game, and it was because it had that four player mode, and especially the putt-putt, the mini golf mode in that game. I thought was really fun because it's just more fast paced and it's more, you know, it has that thing where when you're playing local multiplayer, the other people who aren't, if it's not your turn, you can hammer on the button and annoy the person who's trying to hit the ball with all your crazy voice clips from the characters. That level of absurdity is appealing to me. Playing golf is not, whether I'm, you know, using Princess Peach or not, it really doesn't enhance the experience very much for me. Like, I would be much more interested in a Mario Golf game that would really focused on doing crazy courses and like weird obstacles and bizarre powers and, you know, like really differentiating the characters and the courses in that way. But playing on a normal golf course with Toad, I just don't care. You know, I don't play Tiger Woods, I don't play Hotshot Golf, and I don't want to play Mario Golf if that's what it is.
Yeah.
So, and again, that's not to say it's bad. It just doesn't appeal to me personally.
Yeah, I just wonder how well this will kind of work for me. Like, how much it would appeal to me as a portable game. Because playing it by myself, and how much, I don't know how much I would pay. I'll play it online. I'm just kind of skeptical of that.
I do think that the asynchronous multiplayer is probably a lot of fun.
Yeah.
If you enter a tourney with all the Nintendo World Report people.
Yep.
I could see myself maybe get into that, but
yeah, that's a good feature. That's really smart.
It is. Yep.
But they're releasing Kirby on the same day. I think I've made my choice.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like they put one of those games out there to die.
I'm not sure that I want either one, but Kirby is definitely the more appealing of the two.
Yeah.
It just feels weird that after what feels like months of radio silence, they decided two games today.
Yeah, it's quite weird. So, yeah, jury's still sort of out on it for me.
Two games today, half the marketing budget.
I guess so. Well, Mario Golf does come out this weekend. By the time you hear this episode, it will be available. And it's been getting pretty solid reviews from what I've seen. I mean, I think the guys on our staff who've played the full version of the game, they tend to like it, although they tend to like the other Mario Golf games, so it doesn't necessarily set itself apart that much.
We have somewhat self-selected for reviewers here.
Yeah. Yes.
Sometimes that happens with reviews, you know, it doesn't sound like it's a bad Mario Golf game by any means, but, you know, like, I think after the tennis debacle on 3DS, where that game really didn't sell very well, it didn't get very good reviews, and people, you know, even people who I like Mario Tennis a lot more, it's, you know, a lot faster paced and more, it's simultaneous multiplayer, it's more of an arcade experience.
Mario Tennis is a Mario game and a tennis game in equal parts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Just, you know, more than the golf game is for sure. But it's just, to me, it's a much better multiplayer game because everybody's playing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I also played the original Mario Tennis, the N64 game, pretty recently, and that game holds up really well. That game is still a ton of fun to play.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So, but yeah, I guess after the reaction they got to the tennis game on 3DS, I kind of felt that they might go shoot a little bit higher with this one, and it does sound like it's a better package overall, but I was really kind of hoping they'd get a little more weird with it and like really try to do something a little more innovative with it, and it doesn't really sound like they've done that.
Yeah, but apparently they have
tried to make it a better value at least.
Yeah, but apparently the lack of kind of an RPG mode sort of leaves it, you know, you better hope that you like playing online. Yeah, I mean,
there's a certain expectation that was been created by the series on the handheld games that they'd have this Camelot built RPG mode.
So it's not in there.
I guess like what's funny about the RPG mode was that it did the problem with the current Mario Golf, the demo at least, is that the mini game, quote unquote, is actually a harder version of actual golf,
mm-hmm.
whereas I think that the RPG was actually really good for on-the-go challenges because they were breaking down in bite-sized little challenges, like some of the golfing mechanics. You know, like you had challenges, have the farthest drive, or have, you know, try to putt this from this angle, and so you had these bite-sized challenges that was really good, and here it seems to be lacking. So that's disappointing.
All right. Well, that's Mario Golf. I don't know if we'll talk about that again. It depends on whether one of us decides to buy the full game, but you can certainly read more about it over at our website and hear from people who are maybe more prone to getting into that sort of experience. But that's going to wrap up new business for this week.
Peasants, as it were.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have Retroactive, and we'll talk about the fantastic and the soon to be gone forever online mode of GoldenEye 007 for the Wii. So stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have Hands-On with Renegade Kids Moon Chronicles for 3DS by Zach Miller. I'm not going to say making a first-person shooter on DS was the best idea, but certainly some people love Moon on that system. Will they love an episodic version on 3DS? Zach seems over the moon from his time in PAX East.
I'm so sorry.
Yeesh. All right, and we have a feature. This Week in Japan by Danny Bivens. Danny documents the goings-on with the Japanese eShops. I could tease you about how many virtual console titles Japan is getting, and they are getting quite a few. But they've lost this week. For this week, they received the PC Engine, quote-unquote, classic, China Warrior. Awesome. And China Warrior is one giant sprite-sized failure. I don't know. It's more of a statement. It's a revolution, James. But maybe some other podcast we could talk about that.
The screenshots on the Japanese eShop website right now are amazing.
I'm sure that game is...
It's a Kusoge manifesto.
It is. All right. And we have a review of Mario Golf World Tour for 3DS by Don Koopman. Last week, we expressed the same degree of enthusiasm for Mario Golf World Tour as one would expect for a late tax season revision to the Internal Revenue Code, a detachment that bled into conversation on Mario Kart 8. We're sorry. Don seems to really like it, so we'll be positive here to be positively disinterested.
We have a feature, What I'd Like to See from the NES Remix Series by Justin Baker. Let's just say Nintendo decides to continue to produce these eShop collections / virtual console infomercials. Justin has some ideas about how Nintendo can improve the experience. Among his wants are Japanese-only and third-party games. Yeah, Kung Fu for Remix 3! Yeah!
There we go. Last this week, we have a roundtable. Game Boy turns 25. A look back by the staff. The Game Boy is older than most people listening to the show. Our staff looks back, almost certainly with rose-colored glasses, at their first memory on the system that could be most generously described as ambitious, more accurately as unplayable in lighting conditions that are even slightly less than perfect.
Not true.
An original Game Boy?
The original's not that bad.
It's not good.
All right, guys. Well, obviously, there's a lot going on. There's actually some really interesting news been going on the past few days. So if you have missed out on any of that, you're catching up over the weekend or early next week, do go check all of it out over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Did your voice just change?
I had to burp in the middle of the sentence, so I tried to play it off as like an announcer trick.
Puberty too.
Maybe I'll do it again.
No,
maybe
I think it's fine. It's fine. Just leave it.
All right. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It is time, finally, for Retroactive number 30. We're going to talk about GoldenEye 007 on the Wii, specifically the online mode. And joining the four of us for this special feature is a very good friend of the show, Mr. Nicholas Bray.
Hey, guys. How you going?
It's going great, man. So, Nick, I'm pretty sure we've had you on the show before. It might have been a while.
The end of 2012, I think. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, it has been a while. Well, it's great to have you back, man. I really appreciate you doing this all the way from Australia. I know it's kind of a weird time of day to be doing this, but I really appreciate you coming on. And the reason Nick is here is, number one, he's a big GoldenEye fan. And I first learned this from, I think, listening to Connectivity quite a while ago. A couple years ago, they were doing a segment where they were talking about some of the best, I think it was some of the best Wii games or some of the games of the decade. And they were talking, or no, it was maybe the best games of the last 15 years, something like that. And anyway, there was a special feature on GoldenEye for N64, and Nick read this thing out, and it was maybe 5 or 10 minutes long, and it had lots of really cool trivia, and I was really impressed with your kind of breakdown of the game and why you liked it and why you thought it was really special.
That was when I was doing those little in-focus segments by myself. There's like four of them. So yeah, GoldenEye 64 was the one I decided to do.
Yeah, it was awesome. And so I wasn't surprised to hear that you also are a fan of the Wii version. And, you know, they're different games, completely different games, but very similar. And the Wii game is totally trying to, you know, capitalize on nostalgia for the N64 game. And I think it does a really good job of it in various different ways, maybe the least of which is in the online mode that we're going to be talking about. I think the online mode is much more akin to Call of Duty, and we can get into why that is the case. But anyway, good to have you here, Nick. And actually, last week, you were going to be on the show last week when we were originally going to do Retroactive. But when I decided that we needed to play more of the game, you were game for rescheduling. So I definitely appreciate that. And at this point, we have now all five played the game very recently. In fact, at one point, I think at least John and James and Guillaume and myself were all playing at the same time in the same match. So that was really cool. And that might be the first time we've ever played a game all online at the same time. So we are going to jump into it, I thought let's give a really quick overview of the online features, and you guys jump in here anytime. I don't have a complete list written down here, I'm going kind of off memory, but when you go online with GoldenEye, there is also a local multiplayer mode that's completely separate, different levels, different modes, different, really kind of a different feel to it. But for the online mode, it is set up a lot like a Call of Duty online mode. So you start out and you have two or three loadouts you can pick from. But most of the weapons and equipment and perks are locked. And the way you unlock them is by playing the game. You gain experience when you do certain things, when you get kills, when you do kind of special kills, you get headshots, when you place first, when you get revenge on someone who killed you before, when you stop a streak from happening or something like that. All of these things can get you experience points. And over time, you unlock more weapons and equipment, and you can create custom setups that I think can be a lot more effective than the standard ones go. There's also several different modes. I think unlocked from the beginning, you have about 6 different online modes, that different match types. You know, there's everyone for himself. There's team conflict where you get assigned to teams. You can't really pick your teams, unfortunately. I think they're just sort of randomly assigned.
Yep.
And then there's a number of other kind of free-for-all variants, like Golden Gun, which I think is really fun. And there's the Heroes mode, which is team-based. So we probably all played a lot of these from going through it. I wonder, did any of the modes in particular stand out to you guys, or any of your favorites, or ones that you didn't like at all?
Aside from the conflict and team conflict, I played a bit of Golden Gun mode. Mm-hmm. I ended up liking that a bit. So whenever you've got the Golden Gun, if you kill someone, you get 5 points, but every other time you kill someone, it's only 1 point, and it's the first to 40 points, I think. That was fairly fun for what I played of it. I didn't really go into some of the other modes that much, and I found it a bit annoying that some of the modes are locked and require you to unlock them. I don't think they should have locked them behind experience.
Right. You've already paid for these modes.
Yeah.
Well, weapons are one thing. It's not that, James, but yeah, I think it's just dumb to lock modes because you're going to cut down so much on the number of people playing those modes, it's going to be hard to find a game.
Especially the way they lock them, too. I mean, you have to be, what, level 30, 35, and 40 or something like that? Like, you have to be really high level experience.
One of the last modes is like level 35, which is really high. I was only at level 10. Yeah.
So, yeah, and I mean, right now, I mean, when no one's playing this game, really, it's like you're either going to have a very small body of people that are really high, like 56 or 54 or whatever, or you're going to have complete noobs who can't get into the content. It's just
that's
weird.
The case in all the modes, really. Approach. I mean, the game doesn't even try to matchmake based on skill level, as far as I can tell, which is really silly considering that the skill level is very explicitly defined by, or at least your experience level, is very transparent. Everyone can see it. And you understand how you got to be that experience level. So it seems obvious that they should be able to sort people and try to group people together by similar levels of experience. But every time I've ever played this game, and it goes back to when it first came out, and even now, I've always gotten lumped in with people who are 20, 30, 40 levels of experience higher than me. And, you know, that it doesn't necessarily mean they're better at the game. It could just mean they've played a lot more of it. But it does mean they have access to a lot more equipment and weapons and customization than I do. And
that's the proximity mines I found were really, really annoying.
I don't even know that I've ever seen proximity mines in this game. Like, really? They're so rare. I think you unlock them at such a high level that I never even really saw them.
Oh, no. I mean, I've seen them a lot blowing up in my face or when I didn't even see them. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, I mean, I couldn't equip them, so I would just run around and pretty much just trip off the proximity mines wherever I went because people kept laying them. Yeah. So
there's like one particular level that they like to use proximities on. I found, I forget which one it was, but there was one where everyone seemed to like using that.
Well, what's really cruddy about the whole weapon unlock system in general is that it sort of puts you at this incredible competitive disadvantage in the case of the mines. Mm-hmm. I know in the club, the mines were just awful. Because essentially everything sort of funnels through the same couple corridors. And you're looking at them going, well, I either walk through and blow up or I stand here and get shot. So your choices were pretty limited.
You can't shoot the mines from afar if you see them, right?
Yeah, but if you're running to try to get positioned to fight somebody, it's probably not going to go up. I mean, in general, though, I found that particular level to be just incredibly unpleasant. There's something about this game, and it comes out worst for me in Deathmatch, where it's just a mess of everything going on at one time, where the lighting in the game is kind of funky, and the character models and depth of field have some issues, obviously part because of the Wii hardware. So you have these situations where characters can be really hard to see, but it's especially bad in the dark stages.
Yeah, so what's the one where you're running through the metal sort of scaffolding all the time?
Is that the club?
Which one it is? No, it's the one. It's kind of like an old metal factory.
Oh yeah.
I think that
one is just, man.
I think that's the facility or something like that.
But what's what?
Yeah.
what makes it worse in just straight up deathmatch is that you can't see what you can't see your allies either. And sometimes that's enough to give you some kind of context clue about, hey, there are enemies up ahead. Maybe because they're you know, engaged in shooting or they're running the other way and you're like, oh, I should go with this guy. It sort of mitigates the fact you can't see very well, because at least you can't see very well together.
Hmm. I didn't really have that issue. Maybe I have my gamma correction a little bit too high, but I thought that I could see pretty much everyone all the time. The only time that I was kind of fooled into thinking, oh, okay, there's some guy far away, was in the stages where there's wind blowing and there's debris. But that's on purpose, right? Like, right. There are some outdoor levels where you kind of see, yeah, like dust or whatever, and you think, oh,
pieces of paper,
no, okay,
flying
there's
around.
Nothing there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's in like that's everywhere, even where it makes no sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of odd. But I think the only time I had trouble seeing people was maybe on the jungle level. There's some areas where if you happen to randomly get a character model that has a dark clothing, there's an area that you can kind of walk over on top of some boulders. And the character models do tend to blend in with those boulders, and it becomes a favorite sniping spot for people. And in general, I didn't find sniping was too rampant in this game. It's not as bad as in some other shooters.
It's definitely stage dependent. There are some stages where it's way out of hand.
And well, it depends on the lines of sight, because some levels are much more open, and those tend to be the ones where the snipers are really powerful, and some of them are very twisty and internal and more corridor based, and sniper rifle's not going to do you much good in those.
There was a person in the match that you, Guillaume, and I played in that we were with him for a while, and he was a really high level and had some kind of really stupid sniper rifle.
Oh, yeah, it was like one shot, one kill.
He was just hip firing as he ran around with it. And it's such a broken gun that he basically won every match we were in with it.
I think it was one of the first games, I think Jared was there too, one of the first games where I did some sort of not matchmaking, but I created a team. So all of us low-level dudes were all on the same team. And of course the other team was much more experienced, much more better weapons. And, we got decimated that first match, at least.
Yeah. I mean, I had two things. First off, playing with the Wii remote and nunchuck was just so impossible. Mm-hmm. I had to eventually, Johnny told me to switch over to the Classic Controller Pro, and that worked a lot better, and it was more conventional. But the motion controls, man,
I was using those as well.
See, I could not adjust to them, and probably the hardest thing for me was wasn't necessarily aiming, even though I felt that the aiming had to be really, really precise, especially when you were hitting somebody from far away. Like, I just felt like you had to aim right over top of them to hit them properly.
There's probably a lot less auto-aim when you're using the motion controls.
Yeah, and also I think I had a problem with lag. I felt like even though I would be just, you know, pumping lead into somebody, it would take a while for them to die. I had a real problem with that. It was just kind of laggy.
That might just be your weapon. I know
observed some scenarios where I was just dumping and nothing was happening.
Some of those beginner level machine guns are really weak. Really weak. Yep. And I tended to find one. I would use the close quarters loadout, because I found that the machine gun on there was relatively pretty decent compared to the one in the, I think it's the assault rifle set. And the shotgun is okay, but you have to be so close. I usually people would kill me before I got close enough to use the shotgun.
Right.
Yeah, there was one stage, and it was probably the only one where I had a really good score, that I used the shotgun and it just kind of worked for that one.
I remember
one time.
That one. Yeah, you were killing me quite a bit on that one.
it just happened that the shotgun worked really goddamn well in that stage. And then we changed stages and all hope was lost.
That's the nature of the game. You know, you learn the different level layouts and you learn the different weapons and you learn how to match them up in whatever way is, conducive.
The gun I had success with after I unlocked it was the Sigmus 9. It's like the second one you get. And that one was the one I stuck with afterwards, because I managed to actually start killing people
I found the assault loadout to be really good for basically like all around like whatever stage I was in, But at some point, it was like, okay, I'm going to try a custom loadout, and I'm going to use those gadgets that I unlocked that are supposed to make my aiming better and my weapons more powerful. And how stupid is it that you can unlock those things? I don't understand shooters today. But the problem is, I took basically, I was like, okay, I don't know what any of these guns are. I'm going to choose the first one they give me. And it turned out to be absolutely, like, it did nothing. Like, it tickled, horrible. I guess.
Yeah.
It was horrible. And
there's some really bad guns in this game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe it was good for close quarters or something, but it was the outdoors level with the snow, and I just, I found that match really, really long with that weapon.
Yeah, that was one of the ones where sniping could get real out of hand.
Oh, yeah.
It's true. Yeah. But what I love about that level is it's asymmetric, so it doesn't necessarily feel like it's one side against the other. You know, the jungle level is kind of fun because it's very – I think there's a Team Fortress 2 level that's kind of like this. But it's basically each side has a kind of a fort, and there's a channel. There's kind of a ditch in the middle that you can dump into, but that place is just a bloodbath. You know, I mean, you go down in there and everybody's aiming at you all at the same time because everyone can see you. But there's also this metal bridge that goes across the top, and it's very exposed, but it's the shortest way across. And if you can take that when no one's looking, then, you know, you have a big advantage. And I think those levels are really – those are fun. They're very competitive. But I think usually my favorite levels are the ones that are more asymmetric, and it feels like you can attack it from lots of different angles, you know, lots of different directions. There's useful hiding places all over the place. And just because you learn one half of the level doesn't mean you understand the other half.
That snow one, I was having a lot of trouble on that initially. And then I started basically just hugging the side of the stage and running, like going back and forth. And I was getting a lot of kills, just catching people walking in front of me. Like, that one was really annoying at first because you'd go into the houses and go, oh, hide here for a bit. Nah, you go. You go into those that rubble where the plane is or whatever, and yeah, no, you get killed there too. The only way I could really kill anyone was, yeah, hugging the outside of the map.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you go over by the plane, people can shoot you through the, like, kind of slits around you. So even though you really can't see where they are, they can see you just moving around in there, and they can sit there and snipe you off.
I think probably one of the reasons that you feel so vulnerable in that level is that it's full of snow, and so most of the characters stand out more visually against the backdrop in that level. And so if you get caught out in the middle, everybody can see you, and it's just open season. So sticking to the edges makes more sense, whereas some other levels, you know, I do think some of the Carter levels are fun for that reason, because there's a lot of sort of spontaneous encounters in those levels where it's just all the – actually, maybe my favorite one is, I think it's called the Archive, but it's a very old – it looks like something right out of the 64 game. It's kind of a small building, and it's two stories, and everybody is really close together.
Yeah.
And there's like a secret, there's a secret pathway that you can crawl under and go from one room to the next. And there's a couple of stairways where a lot of action tends to gather around these stairways. And it's just because it's a smaller level, you never have to go very far to find the action, but also there's enough obstacles all over the place that there's a lot of hiding places, and a lot of times you'll just be running and trying to get from one area to the next, and you run across someone else who's doing exactly the same thing. Neither of you is necessarily hunting each other down, but you just sort of very suddenly come across each other, and then it's like, who can react the fastest, who can not freak out, who can take care of the situation. And to me, that is really a lot of what made the original GoldenEye so much fun, and I think that level captures it really well.
Well, there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that, right? The Archive is a classic level. I'm not sure if it's 100% faithful, but it's definitely
not.
Based
no, it's
on
not a,
it.
It's not a recreation, but it is.
The original Archive was far more confusing in the layout.
Yes.
Yeah, it all looked the same.
Yeah.
I found that a lot of times in these stages, I just felt like I was just kind of in the middle of a place, and I didn't necessarily know where I was going. I was just sort of running and shooting when stuff happened. I felt like, I mean, like on the club, I had a sense of how high up I was. But if I looked at somebody across and maybe up a stage, I didn't necessarily know how to get there. I just sort of ran, and eventually I made my way over there.
Yeah,
isn't that kind of every shooter though? I mean, you just learn the levels.
There are certainly shooters where there are, you know, logical layouts with clear visual indicators, where you are, where you need to go, you know, the layout of the stage.
I agree.
I think the nightclub level in particular is intentionally confusing. You know, all the walls are kind of this garish, like pink purple color, and it and just like big solid colors on the walls, and so it makes it hard to tell where you are versus where, you know, some other place that you might have seen before, and what's the difference between these two locations, and how do they connect to each other? And some of the levels are much better than that. You know, it is kind of uneven, I think, the level design. And that's too bad. I mean, there's the stage, the memorial stage. It's like the outdoor statue park. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I've ever played an online match on that level that I enjoyed. It's like, I like it in theory. I like that it's outside. I like that it's kind of at night. I like that there's all these weird statues and big giant heads kind of sitting around all over the place.
I don't think I've played that one.
It rarely comes up. It depends on the mode. Some modes, it's much more likely to come up. But
it never won a vote when I was playing.
Yeah, there's a reason for that.
That's the one that we played in Black Box, right, Johnny?
Yeah, it came up a lot in Black Box, and I thought it was a terrible Black Box level because the Black Box is a mode in which there's this MacGuffin that one side is trying to destroy. Basically, there's a suitcase, and everybody's just trying to shoot it and blow it up. And the other side's trying to get it and run away with it and hold on to it for long enough to hack it. And it's a great idea for a mode, but in that level in particular, the game will spawn the Black Box in this one little kind of fort that's underground. It's in this bunker, and it's very hard to get into. There's only like one or two ways to get into it, and they're very easy to defend. So it's like a race to see who can get to the box first, because once you get to it, the other guys are never going to see it. I mean, it's just almost impossible to approach because the location is too easy to defend. And
it takes way too much time to actually destroy it with the guns that you have typically.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no clear way. I mean, like this thing is sitting on the ground and you have to sit there and just sit there and shoot at it.
Well, of course
and while you're shooting at it, somebody else can come in and kill you.
Right.
And you don't even see them because you're busy staring at this black box shooting at it.
I do think it's probably balanced in such a way that you're supposed to team up and have more than one person attacking it at once.
But
and
there's
then it goes
no way
down
to
fast.
Yeah, that'd be useful with voice chat.
Some of these modes are just a little overly complex considering the lack of communication.
The capture the flag one, I can't remember what they call it in this
game. The GoldenEye mode where you're going on, you're getting the satellite uplink stations scattered around.
Yeah,
that
was really fun. I mean, but it would be much better with voice chat.
Because let me put you this way: I played three or four rounds. I played a bunch with Nick actually, and I don't think we were in one where a side won, because it's impossible. Because part of it is because the game doesn't do, you know, kind of like Battlefield, Team Fortress does it, where there's sort of delineated spawn zones for the two sides. You just spawn wherever the game decides to put you, which makes it really hard to have kind of an advancing front on capture the flag. So you may spawn right next to a firefight. I mean, I once spawned between people shooting at each other. Guess how long I was alive.
Not spawning spawning, I will say, is fairly broken in this game.
I agree. Because it seems just very random.
At least once a match, you will spawn directly in front of somebody who is walking towards you, and they just shoot you. That happens at least once a match.
It's even worse when they throw you on the complete opposite side of a big level, and you get there, and you can tell all the action is on the complete other side.
Yes.
And you spend 2 minutes, 3 minutes just running around. You don't see anyone.
But you finally get to the
firefight, and you're like, finally, I can get some action. You die almost immediately, and then it respawns you way back on the other side again. And it's like, come on, guys.
I would be more okay with that if it just happened that was your side's delineated spawn area, and your side had just managed to push that far.
Right.
Because then ultimately, it's the same path. You can learn it. You can get there quicker.
Yeah, I think Counter-Strike does that.
Yeah. And in that case, it's also sort of a crutch to the team that's currently being beaten backwards, because it takes the enemy longer to get back to them. It's kind of a balancing move. But when it's just you may be the side that's getting housed and you get spawned all the way on the other side of the room, it doesn't help anybody. And it makes your experience less enjoyable.
Yeah, you should be spawning away from the combat, but close enough that it's not inconvenient to get back over there.
The right. my favorite GoldenEye mode one though was I died and spawned next to one of the satellite uplinks. Just nobody around. I captured it. And somebody came and killed me, like as right after I finished capturing it. And I spawned next to another one and captured that, and then the same guy killed me again.
Yeah. Oh,
but at man. No point did he make an effort to capture it, because I think he recognized the pointlessness of the exercise we were currently engaged in.
Yeah. That was a tough mode. I mean, I don't think I know Johnny and I played that mode at least once. And
we did not do well.
No, we didn't. We didn't know what the heck we were doing, because it's not really explained to you.
Right.
Because
right.
it's not just your normal capture the flag kind of mode.
It's hold B. It's a lot like it reminds me a lot of the Battlefield capture the flags.
Like you do have to do them in sequence, I think.
No, you can do them. You can okay. do them. Whatever
see, I still don't even really know how to play it.
So that's the thing, though. So you may see that like one on one side of the map and one on the other side of the map are currently being captured by the same team. Mm-hmm. But damned if I could figure out which one, where those are and where they are relative to one another on the map.
I mean, they come up sort of holographically on the HUD. So, I mean, you can see more or less, you can see the direction that they are.
The thing about the map in this game is that it really only gives you a very tight window about everything else is just kind of out in the extreme direction.
You're right. And the radar does not do a good job of showing you verticality. And some of the levels are very vertical.
Yeah.
And the club, and that
the
makes
club
it really
for example,
tough.
Is probably the most vertical level.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some levels, like, it's not much of an issue, but that one in particular, it can get pretty frustrating.
There's a guy above me somewhere right now.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, I think a lot of these are issues that a game, if this game was released now, regardless of platform, these things would get hammered out because they would just update it. They would patch it, you know, they would rebalance it. But on the Wii, that's just not really allowed. You know, I mean, very, very, very few games really supported any kind of patching feature on Wii.
Did anybody look into what the PS3 version and the Xbox 360 version of this game play like online?
No, I'd be curious to see how different it is.
Yeah, I'd be curious.
I bet there's not many people playing it, unfortunately.
I bet there's nobody playing it right now.
I heard people
now,
but said it's
just too bad because
they weren't happy with the port. It was like worse somehow. I remember people saying it was not as good.
Hmm.
I'm not sure if that's curious. The online mode or if that's just a single player, but yeah, the general consensus.
I'd be curious if they addressed any of these. I mean, because some of these things, I think the people making the game looked at it and said, yeah, it's a concession we made.
Well,
to get
and
the game out.
Especially things like, you know, the infrastructure for how you unlock things. You know, I mean, probably my single biggest criticism of the game, because I think the online mode, for all the problems that we might have had with it, in general, I think at the base level, it's really fun to play. You know, and so I'm willing to put up with lag and the lack of voice chat and confusing modes and things like that, because I think it's the action is just really entertaining and it's addictive. I mean, one night I sat down to play for about an hour and played for three. You know, that's a really good sign. But for me, the biggest issue is that it just takes way, way too long to unlock things. I don't have a problem with the fact that you have to unlock things. I'm used to that. I've played that in a lot of games, including several Call of Duty games. I'm okay with it in principle. I just think they must have thought when they were developing the game that either people would be so addicted to it that they would kind of burn through this stuff way faster, or there'd be so many people playing online that you'd never have trouble finding a match, or you could go to any mode you want at any time and always find a game. And that's not the case. I don't think that was ever the case, but it certainly isn't now in the final days of the service. And if they had the ability to go in and roll in a very simple patch, you know, just kind of update a few values, change a few variables, they could make the experience points accrue a lot faster or have things unlock at a lower level, which I think would rebalance the metagame in a way that really could benefit everyone. I mean, if you're a really high-level player, you don't want to be playing against guys like us who don't have any good guns because it's not as much fun or we're too easy to pick off, you know?
Or maybe you do and you're an asshole.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a few of those, but...
Yeah.
The dude running around hip firing the sniper rifle was an asshole.
Like the
yeah,
whole
there
point
were,
of
there
having
were a couple
a,
guys that just got off on basically getting 40 kills a match.
Yeah.
But the whole point of having a progression system is you want to feel like you're making progress. And it's a problem when you play, you know, for an hour and you win a lot and you get a lot of kills. I mean, I was consistently like right in the middle of the pack. So I'm not a bad GoldenEye player. I played a lot of it. I played several hours of it over the past 2 or 3 weeks. And often I did pretty well. Sometimes I did really well. And yet I never got, I think in the end I was level 8 or level 9 out of 50, 60 yeah. something. So it just takes way too long to build up these levels and unlock things.
I would say I played about 3 to 4 hours. And I did not gain a. I know I gained one level. I'm only like level 7. It shouldn't be that hard.
Yeah, well, it was like 10 experience points for every headshot and things like that. And you got more. Sometimes I would get a whole bunch of experience points, I think, for using the same gun for a long time. It was kind of nonsense.
Like, I recently had a graphic pop up, 500 experience points, and then there was some text, but it was gone so fast I didn't have a chance to read what it was for.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can rank up your guns, apparently. I'm assuming
that. Oh, God.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it seemed like that, because it was saying something like for one of the, I think the very first gun that you have, I forget what it was, but it was saying you have ranked it up to
level 2
something
or...
something yeah, it was something about that. I'm pretty sure that you can sort of rank up your expertise with the guns. I don't even know, but
it's weird. Yeah, I mean the game also the sort of, you know, like built-in game tips for how any of this stuff works is not very clear, so there's a lot of kind of guessing at just what exactly is going on. And like, I think at the end of the matches, they show your, you know, the number of kills and the number of deaths, and they give you the little accolades, which are kind of a nod back to the N64 game. But I would be interested in finding out, what did I get the most experience for? And what am I kind of like, there's no progress bars, you know, like the whole mode is built around progress and building up your profile and getting better and gaining all this experience. But they don't really ever tell you how close are you to the next experience level and what could you do that would be the most productive, you know, like, is there a gun that you haven't been using that you could very quickly get a lot of experience if you just tried to use it for a match? That'd be really useful information, and they don't tell you any of that kind of stuff.
I think I just dislike the whole experience system in general. I like my shooters a little bit more old school.
That's fair.
The whole feeling of progression
I get it.
I don't believe in it, you know. Like, one of the shooters that I really got into was Left 4 Dead, and the feeling of, okay, starting at the lowest difficulty setting and going through every map, and at first it's really difficult, and then, oh, yay, I managed to survive until the end, and then you crank up difficulty, and, you know, it's to do all over again, and you feel, you know, like you're not up to the task, but eventually you get through it. Like, that's satisfying. That's getting better at a game. I feel like you could play this game for a long time without really trying to get better and still, you know, do better and better at it just because, well, you got rewarded for it. It's just lazy. I don't know.
Yeah. Well,
lazy. That's a personal preference, and it's a very valid viewpoint, though, that if you don't like the experience stuff, there's a lot of people
It has to do with adding depth to the games, right, and extending the playtime. That's just kind of the way things have gone. It's like, especially when you have games like this, not so much GoldenEye, but, you know, other first-person shooter franchises that come out every year, they try to, you know, pretty much give people breadcrumbs to try to, like, get them to do stuff and stay in the game, right? Like, so, okay, well, we're going to give you 1,000 guns, and each one of them is going to have, you know, you can rank it up to level 100. And on top of that, you can also rank up your character, and you can rank up this and rank up that. So it's just kind of a bullshit way to extend the lifetime of the title.
I see where you're coming from. People from trading it in. There's a lot of that, you know, and it's a very, if you play a lot of first person shooters, and none of us other than John, I don't know about you, Nick, but none of us four other than John really play a lot of first person shooters. But if you do, these companies are really fighting for your loyalty. You know, I mean, I only buy one or two first person shooters a year, if that. So they don't really have to fight for my loyalty. In fact, a lot of times I don't even play the online modes in these games when I buy them.
No, that's with GoldenEye. I played it a little bit when it first came out, but I haven't touched it until the last couple of weeks. Sometimes I put it on. Like the last time before this, I played GoldenEye online. I was on that memorial level, and the moment I turned it off was when I spawned, and then the red just started coming down the screen. I was sniped before I could move one single step. Like, I was like, okay, that's it.
And then,
I'm over.
And then at the end, they give you the thing that says shortest life. I'm like, of course I had the shortest freaking life. You spawned me right in front of somebody, and I couldn't even react.
Yeah, would it have killed them to give you 2 seconds of invincibility after you spawned?
It's like that
figure out where the hell you are and what's going on.
Did you guys used to play that rule where you couldn't shoot someone in the old GoldenEye? You didn't have a gun. Everyone was like, oh, don't shoot me, I don't have a gun. There was like a thing people used to yell out.
That's Aussie rules, GoldenEye.
Yeah.
No, we didn't do that. But in the original GoldenEye, you never had more than 4 people, and they typically didn't spawn you that close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You also didn't start – I think in most modes in the original GoldenEye, you don't have a gun when you start. And in this game, you always do because you have a loadout. So you never don't have a gun. You're never completely unarmed in this game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's faster paced. I mean, I actually played some GoldenEye 64 pretty recently at a retro game party that a friend had, and that game, like, in some ways it has aged so poorly, but in other ways it's still incredibly fun to play. The multiplayer, I mean, I haven't tried the single player in a long time, and I don't imagine
I played
I would
the,
enjoy that
much. Single player last night, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I played two.
Still liking it.
I played a level of the Wii GoldenEye, the one where you're trying to get into the bunker, the snow level, and then I played the same level on GoldenEye 64 last night, and yeah, actually, the 64 one's not as fun. It's more open. Like, I thought I would enjoy the 64 one more because it was more open, but something about the new one where the more direct path is more a bit more satisfying in a way.
Yeah, is there more like set pieces and
it's not necessarily the set pieces. It's just you know where you're going, and it's more satisfying to sneak up on the guards in the new Wii one because you can sort of crouch down, sneak up, and melee them from behind. In the 64 one, you can sort of shoot them in the back, but then it more than likely alerts everyone else to come. Like, I shot the gun once, like, loudly, and the entire level started chasing after me, so.
Right.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, and I remember in 64 game, a lot of times you would just try to avoid the guys. That was a way to get through some levels.
Well, yeah, and you would get into what amounted to kill rooms where you had to basically take every single person out, and if they tripped the alarm, they would just never stop.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Wii game, we're not focusing on the single player stuff or even the local multi, but I think those are both really good modes. I have never played a lot of the local multi. I played some at E3 before the game came out, and I might have played it once after it came out. And every time I've ever played it, I thought it was really, really fun. And and it's something I always wanted to spend more time with. So maybe the next time we're all together one way or another, we can spend some time with that. And by the way, Guillaume, that mode does not have experience points. Everything's unlocked from the beginning.
Yeah,
you just pick what you want and you go after it.
Yeah, I heard there was basically 2 multiplayer modes, like one local where it's more like the classic GoldenEye, and the other one where it's more Call of Duty-ish and experience points and everything.
See, in one of the
it's the same maps, though, right?
They're modified. I think they're smaller. So it's more cramped, like, to be more like the original GoldenEye.
All right, so we've talked a good bit about the modes and the levels and the progression and everything. What about the online performance? Did you guys find? I mean, the party features, the putting in the friend codes, teaming up with a party, finding an open match, lag.
The party features was. Like, you could join someone, and then as soon as the game was over, or you exited that lobby, your party was disbanded, and you had to resend an invite and stuff. That was annoying.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually had a situation where I guess Johnny had gotten kicked from the match, or he had just because it said you had signed off, and which I mean, hey, it's a Wii game that tells you when people on your friends list sign on and off.
Well, true.
Novel.
But it then had you send me a party invite while I was in-game, but I couldn't figure out a way to respond to it in-game.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
So, and then it expires very quickly.
Yeah, there was a couple of times where it was like, party invite has expired, and I was like, what? I received something? I never noticed.
So, I think you have about a minute to respond, but there's no way you're getting out of a match to that screen in a minute.
Right, yeah. And you can't pause during the match, so...
Yeah, I mean, I was just sitting there going like, all right, well, I'm done.
Yeah, I also thought it was weird how it seems like you had a whole bunch of room for multiple party invites. Like, tons of party invites.
maybe you're real popular, John.
Well, no, but I mean, I would get one invite, and I would just expect to go to, you know, a screen with, you know, Johnny, like one name on there, and it would be like Johnny's name at the top of like a list with like tons of slots that you could just scroll down. Like,
maybe
some
people are more popular than you, John.
I don't know. Maybe.
But in terms of performance, it wasn't too laggy over here. And if anything, the biggest problem I had was the Wii U system froze at least twice on me.
Really?
So just that was annoying. Crashed?
So I actually had
a hard reset at one point.
Yeah.
It just froze up trying to connect to the network.
Yep.
So I will say that when I tried to play this on the Wii U, it would crash as soon as it tried to read the disc. Hmm. But on the Wii, it was fine. And I play other Wii games on my Wii U. So I'm wondering if maybe this game just has something that doesn't play nice with the Wii U.
It worked fine on my... I don't even own a Wii anymore. They were all, you know, filled with mud. So I play this game on Wii U and it worked perfectly fine. I had very little lag. The biggest problem I had in terms of performance was that sometimes the game host would disconnect. And it would basically end the match, and it would say trying to find a new game host, but it never succeeded in that. It would always end up just kind of kicking me out. And I don't know if that is a network problem where someone just lost their connection, or if it might be someone who just kind of quit. And you know, I mean, you could imagine that maybe they just turned the system off in the middle of the match because they were losing, or you know, their mom was calling them, or any number of reasons. But it doesn't know, and it doesn't really give you much information about what's happening. But I know I was always hoping when that happened that it would be able to find a new host and kind of get the match restarted.
I don't know why it couldn't find a new host. I mean, if there's people on there, why couldn't it just keep going?
Right.
But you know, I've had this in pretty much every online game I've ever played that has a dedicated host. I don't think I've ever played an online game where it's like, hey, I'm going to find a new host. I got one. Everything's great. Mm. Some old Battlefield games would do that, but really that game was being hosted on a server.
Yeah,
the host was kind of a host in name only kind of deal.
Well, I will say as many issues as I have with the party system, because I do think it's a bit of a mess and you know needed a few
it's
extra
extant, which gives it a leg up on most games.
Exactly. I mean, it is useful. Like you can actually get on there. It sort of. It validates the time and effort you put into putting in all those friend codes. Because once people are on your friends list and they're online, you can send them a party invite. And we often, you know, the four or five of us, Jared was on there, Neil was on there, I think the first time, or maybe not Neil, but someone else from staff was on there. And then several people from our forums who had given us the heads up that they were going to be playing, like Mop It Up and Fat Bond, Fatty the Hutt. There were a number of familiar names, and I could go in there and send a few party invites, and two or three people would join my party, and I would go and start a match, and then we were all playing together. And that was nice, because otherwise it's sort of the luck of the draw.
Yeah.
You know, it's like even if you do have people on your friend list, you kind of go down there and you say, you know, connect to their game. It'll say, well, they're not in a game. Fail. Or they're in a game, but it's already full. Fail. Or they're in a game, but let's try to bring you in and wait for a spot, and you wait and you wait and you wait. And sometimes I felt bad because I know there were people trying to join some of our games the other night when we had the official event going on. Mm. And we had a full lobby, and almost everyone in the match, like almost all eight people, were all NWR affiliated people, either staff members or podcast people or you know, fans, people from the forums. And so I know there were other people trying to join our games, and they couldn't because there were no slots. And they would until the end of a match, but then all of us would just roll over into the next match again, so no slots would open up.
I actually ran into that problem trying to get into a match. I mean, I sat there for about 25 minutes.
That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it doesn't tell you when you try. It should just tell you at the start, hey, he's in a match that's full right now.
Or... It'd be nice if you could just do a friends-only match. You know, yeah. I mean, it only holds eight people. So it's reasonable to think that in certain circumstances, you might be able to fill up an entire match or at least get the minimum of, what, four? You know, that's probably the minimum to have a good match.
That would have been a good, like, you know, because then we would, like, sometimes when you play, say, just me and James or when I was playing with Danny for a bit, it would have been helpful if we could have just gone into a level with, like, a few people that we knew maybe, and played it to learn how to play more so.
Yeah, or maybe there's someone in there you don't like and you could kick them out because you're the host.
Yeah.
You know, it's like all these other people are my friends and they're cool. You're not cool. You're playing the game poorly, or you're way too, you're like way, way, way higher level than the rest of us, and you're messing up the whole balance of the game. Or we want to make room for one of our other friends to pop in here. I mean, the, you know, at least a semi-private match where you have some kind of moderator control of who's in the game and who's not. But there really should have been a private match option. And I think that hampers it, because even in the late days here of the game, there were enough people online who clearly have been playing it for a long time. You know, these people are level 58 and 59. Mm. And they've got weird brackets and symbols in their names that kind of indicate that they're members of some kind of clan. an online Wii game clan. It's hard to imagine, but they are out there. And we were getting matched up with them, and I would have much rather have been able to have some kind of filter where I could have only played with people from my friends list or their friends, you know, friends of friends. And other games have these features. And again, I think these are things that probably could have been patched into the game, but the system itself didn't really allow for that, which is a real shame, because damn it, GoldenEye is a fun game. I mean, it's messy. It's definitely of the time and of the platform. But it sure as hell is a fun game to play online on your Wii. And that's going away very soon. A whole big chunk of this game.
It's easily one of the best Wii online games.
It's the best one I've played,
besides Mario Kart, maybe.
Yep.
I think this and Mario Kart are you know, the kings. And Mario Kart has a lot of these same problems. I mean, it's more polished overall. I think the experience is not as sort of janky. It's not as menu based. It's not as confusing about what the hell's going on with all this stuff. But it also doesn't have as many features or options in terms of teaming up with people. And I think GoldenEye and they're just so completely different games. I mean, the things that you do when you're playing them are so different that it'd be nice. This is exactly why Microsoft and eventually Sony and then eventually Nintendo kind of came up with a unified architecture so that you have some consistency across games, because you have games that are really fun to play online, but you can't because of various technical issues or because not enough people are playing them. And you've got other games that are amazing games and you would love to be able to play them online, but then they don't really work at all. And that's stuff like Smash Brothers.
I've never played that online.
Yep. Yep.
Did you never attempted or you never succeeded?
I attempted it.
I
will say
everybody attempted at one time or another.
I will say one game that has an online mode that it's a shame we didn't do it when we did the retroactive on it is The Last Story, which is a really interesting squad based online mode that I actually enjoyed a couple times I play it, but that's also going away and no one will have ever played it but me and the bots I was playing with, because there's no way those were people.
I mean, I have to give props also to I think it's Modern Warfare. I think Reflex Edition?
That's actually
well done as well. Mm. That's good.
I would love to see a GoldenEye sequel, because I think the foundation they laid in this game is so promising, and there's so much good stuff in the game. Mm. Not just online, the local multi and the campaign is great too, other than the last boss.
That's garbage. Was 007 Legends any good?
No.
I think it was terrible.
I remember hearing that the 360 version, when the early reviewers went out, it was janky as hell.
I didn't think it even came out here.
This is really one of the only good James Bond games since the original GoldenEye on N64.
Everything or Nothing was really good.
I really liked Eurocom's last one, Nightfire, on the GameCube as well.
Yeah, Nightfire was one of the few Bond games that really seemed to care about stealth. Mm-hmm. Because you could get through whole missions without shooting your gun. I think there was actually a reward for beating the game with like only killing bosses.
And I know Neil is a fan of From Russia with Love, which I was always curious about because it has a jetpack.
I ran into a wall with that. It's just like there was a lot of later levels just have tons and tons of enemies. And you just like,
Yeah, but I mean, there have been a few that are kind of relatively successful, but I really do think GoldenEye on the Wii is the best one since the first GoldenEye, and I would love for them to just make a call it GoldenEye 2.
How about GoldenEye Rogue Agent?
That sounds so dumb, but Yeah.
The story could be that you get a golden eye.
No, that's been tried. That's a bad idea.
That's pure Hollywood, Guillaume. It's golden. Pardon the pun.
Oh boy.
But it really would be great to play this on, you know, a more competent online infrastructure, because it's really fun. And I do think, although, you know, the game is heavily leveraged on Call of Duty, you know, in the style that series had established, and, you know, is from Activision, so that's not any coincidence. But still, I think they do a lot of interesting things to make it still feel not only like a James Bond game when you play online, but also to make it feel like GoldenEye when you play online.
I really didn't feel like I was playing James Bond.
No.
I don't know. It was just a shooter. But then again, I didn't try the black box stuff, or it was just the most GoldenEye thing was the golden gun. But again, it's just a rush to get the golden gun. It's just another multiplayer shooter.
The golden gun mode is so much fun, though.
Would have been cool to have Bond characters in the online multiplayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody's just nameless goons. So it does debond the whole experience pretty thoroughly.
Well, that's the thing. You can assume... you know, when it says a hero has entered the fray, which I got a kick out of because it was just constant throughout some of the matches.
Yeah,
and you can assume, I think you can actually become James Bond, and I don't really know what that gets you, but you can also become, I think, Zhukaev or
you can be, become
Russian
Trevelyan.
Character.
That's the heroes mode. That's kind of that's an interesting mode because they add more voice acting to that mode. The other modes tend to be, like, in terms of audio, a little dry.
Stuff like straight out of like the old Star Wars Battlefront games, where if you played really well, they would spawn you as a movie character, made you even more stupidly powerful.
Yeah,
and
you get more health. There's a regen effect when you're near other characters, and the fun thing is it highlights you on everyone else's radar, so everyone kind of comes to you all at once. It makes you a big target, but you are more powerful, and if they kill you, they get extra points. So everyone's suddenly very incentivized to really come after you, but you have all these bonuses. So I think that mode is actually pretty cool.
Oh, I had no idea what I was doing, and I became the hero. Yeah. And the first time I got killed immediately, but the second time I actually took out the other hero, and that gave me a bunch of experience points.
Yes.
But other than that, I had no idea. Like, there was no indication that I was healing my team members or anything like that.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not communicated very well. Again, I would love for them to get another chance to do this and really fix all that stuff, because there's so many good ideas.
Maybe they can port it to the Wii U from the 360.
Let's just make a new one. Let's just make a sequel.
Yeah, please.
Make it better.
Please make a new one.
Yeah. Hey, let's port the PS3 version with move controls
at this point. It's probably the most likely game that we could get.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still think Nintendo would kind of flaunt it all over the place if they got a new GoldenEye game on Wii U. I think they'd make a big deal out of it.
GoldenEye 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it. Let's do it. All right, guys. Well, that's going to wrap up our retroactive discussion. Thank you, everyone who participated, who played online with us or against each other, who left comments. You know, the forum thread was really more of a friend code and matchmaking service this time rather than a repository for people's comments. But a couple of people did leave very long posts on there with some really good insights and really good observations about the game. So I would recommend you go check it out if you haven't already. And if anything we've said has made you curious and you want to go try this game, the online mode is very, very short-lived here. It is going away in a couple of weeks. So this really is your last chance. And if you own the game especially and you've never played it online, I think it's well worth your time to check it out and sort of get a flavor for what we're talking about here, because it's going away very soon, and I am sad about that, although I do kind of, in principle, I agree with John that Nintendo Wi-Fi connection can't die soon enough, because it is sort of it's sort of abhorrent, but nevertheless there were good games made for the service, and in some cases it is worth putting up with all the dumb bullshit of Nintendo Wi-Fi connection in order to play these games online, and GoldenEye is one of those examples. So thanks, everyone, for participating. We'll do another retroactive at some point. It will probably be a little bit simpler than this one to set up. So and maybe a little bit shorter fuse on it. But really appreciate you coming and doing this with us, Nick. I wish I'd gotten to play with you online a little bit more. I think we did once or twice, but the time zones make it tough. So, but I hope you had fun with it, man. And we'll try to get you back on the show soon. Also want to let people know that the new Famicast is out, new episode of that. If you're a subscriber, you should already have it. But some people aren't, and so I want to let them know that they should go check it out. It's like our show, but it's all about Japan. So I know you will like it. Go check it out. Some great personalities over on that show, and they have a lot of fun. And next week, we are definitely going to catch up on some listener mail. We've gotten some fantastic emails lately and some wonderful responses to the segment last week where we talked about episode 400 and some potential plans for that. Got some great feedback on that, some for, some against, and a lot of just great ideas that we hadn't even thought of. I definitely would never have thought of some of this stuff that people are throwing out there. And I'm really excited about the possibilities. So we'll have an update on that maybe in a couple of weeks as I get more time to look into it. But any other topic you want to talk about, let us know. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we will look forward to hearing from all of you and answering your questions next week. So that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back next time here on RFN.
Bye.
Bye.
Later.
Bye.
Bye.
The dialogue is in rhyme, which is just about as. Sorry about that.
That's awesome.
Avast, I didn't have to ask who that was.
French, Avast updated.
French Avast antivirus. That's pretty great.
Avast, yeah.